Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Good morning again. Listen, we're in a series in Ephesians. We've been working from, last week in August or so, and we worked through the theology in the fall, and now we're working through the practical. We're looking at the outline of the practical application of that theology. We looked at marriage and family, and then we looked at marriage, and then we looked at parenting, and we're in our fourth week on work now. And so much of the application of the theology is based on this, is the pivotal verse, chapter 4, verse 1, where Paul says, you know, as a prisoner of the Lord, then, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling that you received. And so, you know, live a life worthy of your calling in your marriage. Live a life worthy of your calling in your parenting and as a child for your parents. And then live a life worthy of your calling in work. So this week, what I thought I would do is I'd bring a friend along to help kind of explain and illustrate what it's like to live a life worthy of the calling in the workplace. This is Dean Rush. We met several months ago. We were both speaking at the First Evangelical Free Church. So many of you are from there, men's retreat. And I heard his story and thought, I'm going to figure out how to get him up at Grace. Dean has a crazy, he's lived four lives. grew up in Indiana, so of course he played basketball and even played professional basketball. Then he went into the military as in the Air Force, where he served us and our country and was a distinguished combat veteran in part of the Special Ops Forces, Special Operation Forces. And when he was over there, his jet was shot down and his co-pilot was injured terribly. And the evacuation was necessitated that his co-pilot leave immediately. And so Dean was left in the jungle with some other men. And that was the night that they sprayed the jungle with Agent Orange. So Dean would find out later on that he was a cancer survivor. After the military, he came and started an airline, Emerald Airlines. Didn't know you couldn't do that, so he did. Then did several other businesses. We're gonna walk through his business history. But the other reason I wanted him up here is because he knows what it's like to be in business and in ministry. He was asked to join the staff of Community Bible Church, a fantastic church in San Antonio. Many of you know about it. And he was there when it was small, and now it's just huge. And then eventually he was the executive pastor there for,
8 years.
8 years. Then moved up to Austin, and he's been serving as the executive pastor with Rob Harrell down at First Evangelical Free Church for 2 years. Been a huge help to him. So this is the legend, Dean Rush. Thank you, Dean, for joining us today.
Thank you.
So kind of the umbrella question in light of so many different types of careers you had, right? You just follow orders in the military, hopefully. And then you give orders as a business owner, as the president, and then you've done everything in between. Can you think of a common principle, I guess, that would guide you in the way you've chosen to do work over the years?
I think it took a while to learn it, Matt, but the common thread really is trying to find God's purpose.
Right.
And if we work toward finding God's purpose, we find ourselves with Him. And as long as we're with Him, things seem to work out.
Right. But that was a long time. It wasn't a direct route. It kind of starts all the way back to after your father passed.
Yeah, I was 16. I had a brother, 13, and two brothers that were 10. And we lived on a farm in Indiana. I had learned to fly the backdoor neighbor. Was a flying farmer, and I would wash his airplane. He landed and took off in a pasture field, so you can imagine what I was washing. And I started flying there and became sort of an obsession. But at 16, my world came apart, and my dad died very suddenly. Well-meaning grandfather invited the welfare people to come out and talk to my mom because we just purchased the farm, and there was no way to survive. And this lady came out. We were sitting around a table like this, and my three brothers and I, my mom and this lady from the welfare office, and she looked at Mrs. Rush, my mom, and said, "Mrs. Rush, if you really want to be able to pay for this farm, you probably need some more education. So I suggest we put these boys in a foster home, and you go back to school for a while. Mom had a high school education, but she was supposed to go to business school. And when the lady said that, my next younger brother and I walked over very gently. He picked up one arm, I picked the other arm, and we walked the lady from the welfare office out to the car, gently put her in the car, and we were walking back into the house, both of us crying our eyes out, and we looked at one another, and I don't know who said it first, but we said, "We'll never be poor." And suddenly that became the scorecard for life. I decided that I didn't want to be poor. And God provided avenues, so that's kind of where it all started, I think.
Right. It starts there. It ends with you just trying to be in God's will, and it's a long and difficult journey. Well, after you after 11 years in the military, and you started a business, right, Emerald Airlines. Right?
Yeah, a couple other guys and I started Emerald Airlines, hauling small packages in Texas. Some of your older folks might remember it. We didn't know you couldn't start an airline. So I was co-pilot and director of marketing. And if you called, there were three employees when we started. And if you called the office and someone said, "May I speak with the marketing department?" And you answered the phone, you put them on hold and take them off hold and say, "Hi, marketing department." And you change. We were trying to be bigger than we were, and it didn't work out well. But we learned a lot about business, and it was a purposeful education.
And then you ended up in a small little airport.
Yeah, I left there after about 5 years, and we went down to Lockhart. We wanted our kids to grow up in a small town. And so we moved to Lockhart, and I rented what was just the airstrip at that time and started a business, buying, selling airplanes, repairing airplanes, teaching people how to fly, and selling fuel. And the whole family was involved. And truthfully, in the airline, I had been so engrossed in the business that I just sort of waylaid my family. And I was spending so much time that became the obsession. Well, it was quite the opposite in Lockhart because everybody was involved. And I began to realize that there was something really important in business. Money will come and go, but the only two things that last are faith and family. And so we were able to begin working there and kind of starting from scratch. And one day a customer came in, and we'd been in the business, I guess, a couple of years at that time. A customer came in and said, "Who financed all this?" And I said, "Well, Vicki and I just started it from scratch." And he said, "Well, I have a large bank account, and if you really want to get big," he said, "I could make you a star because we could take my bank account and what you're doing here, and we could really make this a large business." So I went home and I spoke with Vicki, and I said, "We have this opportunity. What do you think?" And she's pretty direct, and she said, "Why?" And
you had everything going in Lockhart, right?
I was teaching Sunday school. We had a great time with our family, and they were working in the business. And we weren't making a lot of money, but we were making money to live on and had a nice home. And she said, "Why?" And sometimes husbands do. I kept thinking, you know, I could be a big businessman. So I accepted the offer and sold half the business to this man. We went down, got a big credit line. Everything was going fine, and we're growing like crazy. And I started feeling kind of bad, lost about 15 pounds in a month, had a charter pilot that didn't show up one day, and I had a charter customer that night, and I decided I had to fly him, but I wasn't feeling well. So I went to a friend of ours who was a doctor, and I said, "I need you to fix me." And he said, "What do you mean, fix me?" And I told him what was going on, and he said, "You're not flying. You have to go see some doctors and get some checks done." And we had those checks accomplished, and they announced that I had stage 4 cancer.
That was from Agent Orange.
It was from Agent Orange. We didn't know at the time, right, but many people have experienced it since. So to make a long story short, the business had a tough time surviving because everything revolved around me. And as we began to work through this event, and I was in and out of the hospital a lot. I'd go in, have surgery, and recover, and be at home. Vicki was working diligently. The kids were working. And by the time, I guess a few months had passed, it became evident I wasn't getting a lot better, and it was really getting tough. So a friend of mine who worked with me at the airport came and picked me up one day, and he was trying to bolster my spirits, and he took me out to the office. And when I got there, I was going to go out and look, because when I was in the hospital, my partner, I thought being very nice, had brought the loan papers in to renew a loan we had for some of the airplanes and inventory. And I signed them in the hospital, and I thought, man, that's great. He recognizes what I'm doing and me as a partner, and I guess someday I'll get back there if God wills it.
But so he had you sign these loan papers, and also he had taken out some insurance on you.
Yeah, I was such a rock star. He took Key Man Life Insurance policy out of my life.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah,
Key Man Life Insurance.
Yeah, it sounded really good on paper, and it was worth a lot of money. It made me worth a lot of money, I guess. So I signed these papers. I had the life insurance policy, and my friend takes me to the airport. And when we're out there, I look around, and the airplanes that were on the inventory list weren't there. And I said, where are they? And I was told that they had been sold just to raise some cash for the business since I was homesick. And I said, well, was the bank paid? No, the bank wasn't paid. And so I went to my partner and said, hey, we've got to go tell the bank because they, you know, I signed these papers. And he said, no, you'd be silly to do that because, in fact, you'd go to jail if you do that because you're the one that signed the papers. And besides, you could ruin the whole thing, Dean, because we have the Key Man Life Insurance policy. We'll pay back the little bit that's owed to the bank or the amount that's owed to the bank, and we'll split what's left after you die.
So let me make sure everybody understands what just happened. He took out a loan for collateral with these two or three airplanes. He sold the airplanes for the cash. And the way he was going to pay them back was at your funeral, collect Key Man insurance, and take the money and run. So he was literally banking on your death.
That was the plan.
That was the plan. Where'd you find this guy?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I interrupted the story. So...
Well,
so he's threatening you that you'll go to jail if you tell the bank that the collateral is gone and sold.
Yeah, and the timing was not that superb, as you might imagine, because I was sick and I had a short-term prognosis for life. And it was a tough, tough time for us. And Vicki and I prayed diligently through the whole thing. And I told the partner, I'll tell you, we'd be good if we went to the bank. So I'll give you 30 days. And we had some money in the bank, as a matter of fact, when I checked. I said, well, it's going to be paid back when you die. So a few days, about 30 days later, a good friend of mine who worked with me put me in his pickup truck, and I couldn't drive, drove me to San Antonio to the bank. And we're sitting across from the banker at his desk. And I was beginning to tell him what had happened and the fact that somehow I was going to be able to pay that back. I didn't know how at the time, but if he would work with me. And he said, Dean, we wondered what happened and why you took this guy on as a partner, because you're the only partner he has left out of like 23. I didn't spend any time checking him out. And as I sat there, the phone rang and he answered his phone, and then he handed the phone to me. And it was my partner, and he said, you're fired. And he could do that. He owned 51% of the company. And so I was then without a job and without insurance and a very short prognosis for life. Went home, spent a lot of time praying, a lot of time on the couch. Vicki was at work. Remember it well. It was a dreary day in February. Very cloudy. The kids are at school, and Vicki's working. And it was just me and the family dog. And I got down off the couch, got on my knees, and I had spent my whole life building what I thought were companies and trying to control everything. And I realized, and I said to God, God, I can't do it anymore. I've done everything I can. I've made a lot of mistakes, and I need you to take control. And it wasn't because I was a good guy, and it wasn't because of anything I did, but God began to repair my cancer at that time. And I tried to get jobs all over the place and couldn't.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to When you're interviewed, you say, I have 6 months to live, it's hard to want to employ you.
Yeah, they would always smile and say, hope you're going to be okay.
Well, but that was the couch and dog story is dramatic because I think you took the job with this gentleman because you swore to your brother we'd never be poor. And this is where it led. And then on the couch, it was, I'm going to do what God says to do.
Yeah, it was a major turning point.
Right.
And 2 Corinthians 6:14 says that we should never be equally yoked. And that doesn't stand just for marriage. It stands for business. It stands for relationships. It stands and can be guiding for your life that you take on people who think like you do.
Right. Let me read it. I want you to listen to how many times he says this. He's repeating it over and over again. He says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers. For what does righteousness and wickedness have in common? What fellowship can light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? What does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? And you know, what does he say? It's 6 times here in 2 verses. That's kind of the punchline of that story in your life.
Very direct. Very direct.
I'm sorry. So from there, you were able to finally get a job, but it was just to get insurance or...
It was. I had tried over and over again to find jobs in aviation in various places. And when I was with Emerald, we built a little fixed base operation here in Austin called Austin Aero at the time. And I'd hired a guy who had since left and gone to American Airlines because they were buying fixed base operations like the little place we had in Lockhart. But they were in big scale all over the country, all over the world. And he called me and said, Dean, we need someone with airline experience and fixed base operation experience. And would you come to work? And before he finished the sentence, I said, yes. I asked if I could get insurance for my wife. And Dale knew what my prognosis was. And he said, yeah, I can get it for Vicky. I can't get it for you. He offered me the job and I accepted it. And it was making exactly, and this is God's sense of humor, it was making exactly 10% of what I had made the year that I had gotten sick. I was tithing in reverse.
Yeah. But when we spoke at lunch, you said you took the job because you needed insurance for your family, and it was some kind of income. And is that a good reason to take a job?
It's a reason to take a job at the time if you feel that you're going where God wants you to go. And he had left me an avenue. I mean, I kept spurring off into various avenues, and he kind of brought me back in and focused and said, if you want to eat, son, here's the job.
It's a good reason to take a job.
So
and you were able to help them. You had expertise in this field, and you brought that. You succeeded quite well in Michigan, so much so that they promoted you.
They promoted me to senior vice president of the central region of the country for the company, and that was everything from the Mexico border to Canadian border and spread throughout the central part of the United States.
They gave you the pick of where to go and what to do in that region, and you decided to go to Indiana.
I decided to go to Indiana. My mother had been ill, and my brothers were there, and I just thought it was an opportunity. But Indianapolis had been one of the key cities for that area and had been very profitable. And, of course, my job was to make the sector profitable. And very suddenly, a few years prior to my nomination of that job, it had turned around, and it was losing money. And they had a large contract with Federal Express. There's a big hub. Their international hub is in Indianapolis for FedEx. And we sold about 6 million gallons of fuel a month. And about 370-plus employees.
If you can't make money and FedEx is your major carrier or your client, then there's something seriously going wrong there.
It was.
Right.
It was.
It wasn't what you'd expect. And that's the great part of the story.
Actually, prior to going there, there's something else I should probably tell you about. I just prior to ending my stay in Grand Rapids, I was called one day by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You don't get calls from them very often. And they asked me to come down and talk to them. And I went down, and I had, in fact, prior to leaving Texas, going to the FDIC, told the story to the FDIC, said, we're going to pay you back any way we can. They said, fine. The FBI agent, very nice guy. His children were missionaries, and we had a lot in common. And he asked me to tell him the story. So I told him the story, and his last words were, "Mr. Rush, if you're in my sector, you probably have nothing to worry about." However, 30 days later, he called me and said, "Dean, I hate to tell you, but you've been indicted on 5 counts of bank fraud." And so we spent a year from that time, and now we're moving to Indianapolis. And we'd spent a year actually flying back and forth to San Antonio to talk to the investigators there in this group about the loan.
The loan, and it's about $280,000?
It was about $280,000. Right. And we had paid back some, but we hadn't touched the $280,000. During that year, the judge told me 3 times. We met with the folks, and they had said, "Dean, if you can't remember having signed the papers, it might be tough to prove this." And as we talked, though, truthfully, I knew I'd signed the papers. I'd signed them with a witness in the hospital, and we just sort of waited and waited and waited for that year. As the year passed, we ended up in court in San Antonio because I signed a plea bargain and truthfully had said, "Yes, I signed the papers." And so
that was a hanging judge that you were before.
It was a judge. The day that I was sentenced, they sentenced the first guy to life on a drug deal. They sent the next guy to 15 or 20 years on a drug deal, and I was third. And the judge asked again, you know, if I had signed the papers. And I said, "Well, yes, I did." He said, "I'll tell you what, Mr. Rush, and he knew the story, and he said, if you'll agree to try to pay it back, if you can pay $1.50 a month, I'm going to sentence you to 5 years of probation." At the same time all this was occurring, my partner kept asking me to pay for the life insurance policy. And
still hoping you were going to die.
Yeah. And I went to an attorney friend and said, how do I separate myself? And he said, "Dean, it's just like a divorce." He said, "You know, you have a contract." And so in order to separate, and for that reason, Vicki and I had to declare bankruptcy, which was a really tough prideful thing, and we declared bankruptcy, but we decided between us we would start trying to pay everything back, the banks and anyone affected by the bankruptcy. We prayed through that time, and in Indianapolis some really good things began to happen, and God provided good business, and we learned a lot from that time too.
But still, an Indianapolis farm boy with those kind of values had to really humble himself to file bankruptcy to get out of this relationship with a man praying for your death so he could get out of trouble. You have $280,000 and a federal indictment against you, but you're on parole, I guess, for 5 years.
Probation.
Probation.
Yeah.
Right? And you're having to check in with a probation officer every time you leave the county.
Yeah. Every time I left the county, I had to call a probation officer. And I was being sent all over the country and the world for the company. So we got to know one another pretty well.
Right. And you end up down in Indianapolis now. Mm-hmm. And now let's figure out how to fix this base camp for FedEx.
The business side of Indianapolis was very interesting. As I said, I think there were 371 employees there. There were about 37 of those employees that worked in the administrative office. They had a great social atmosphere because they said every Friday night, everybody went to this one particular bar. You really had a good time. You forgot about anything else. And as I was there for a very short time, I began to hear stories, and I realized within 2 weeks I could count there were at least 16 affairs going on. And then in my mind I began thinking about what those affairs meant and how it permeated into the workforce. Because as I said before, I was told that more than a 70% annual turnover in the workforce. So if you're a mathematician, it doesn't take too long to understand. If 70% of 370 plus people are leaving, and they're leaving because of probably insecurity, or they don't like the job, or maybe they don't like the person they're having the affair with, or they think there's going to be a complication in their life because of it. And it takes $2,500 to $2,800 minimum to retrain someone to safely put fuel in these big airplanes, put on new uniforms, have somebody train beside them so you can double that cost. And you can. And I began to realize that's probably the key in why this went from making $1 million a year to losing $2 million a year. So during that time, Vicki and I had been privileged to have gone to a national prayer breakfast, and I met at that prayer breakfast two ladies that had just finished their master's thesis based upon family. And one of them...
In the workplace.
Yeah, it was right. Bringing Christ into the workplace. So we thought about it, talked about it. Vicki suggested I call them. So I called. They flew to Indianapolis. The first thing they did when they got there, and I was going to have them tell me how to fix this problem. And they asked me, Dean, do your employees lie to you? And I said, no, we don't allow people to lie to us. They get fired if they do that. And they said, well, do you give them sick leave? And I said, we do. We give everyone 7 days of sick leave per year. And they said, well, do you give them sick leave if their child is sick? And I said, no, it's just for them. And they said, let's see, your workforce, the median age is about 30 years old, 35 years old. Most of them are married, and you're telling me you don't allow them to tell you if their child has the mumps? They're lying to you. So we began, it was from that vision I began to realize, and the social deal on Friday nights and the affairs, that you know what, everybody here is being looked upon as an object and not as a couple. And so through the suggestion of Marcia Kempthorne and Marcia Coates, we began to change the way we did business. And if someone achieved some exceptional thing, we would give they and their spouse tickets. And we didn't give them tickets to a movie or to a big dinner in a fancy place. We gave they and their spouse tickets and movie tickets. And if they did something really big, we gave the couple in front of everybody a four-day cruise. And we did things that brought family into the workplace. And then, should I tell them the other place?
Sure. Yeah.
If any of you are in HR, this might not be a good good lesson. But I kept thinking there has to be these people are crazy. You know, we've got this problem permeating through the workforce. 70% of the people are leaving. And it was all because of these affairs. And so I called the HR lady, who's about 4'9", and I'm 6'4". And I told her to set up 370 chairs in a hangar on a Friday morning. And if they were off that day, we'd pay them double overtime. But I wanted every employee there at 10 o'clock on Friday morning. We walked from our office to the hangar at about 9:55, and she's saying, what are you going to say? What are you going to say? And I had already determined what I was going to say, because we had a door. I asked them to leave the door just one person wide, so everybody coming in had to see every person entering the place. And I made sure that this lady and I were the last two into the hangar. Walked in, and all the chairs were filled, and my speech went something like this. I said, I'm aware of all the affairs and the social deal and everything with this place, but we're losing money, folks. And so the next person I hear of having an affair, if any of you, you're fired. And I turned around and walked out. Shortest speech I ever made in my life. She made the longest speech she's ever made in her life as we're walking back to the office telling me how we couldn't do it. But my theory was really pretty basic. It was, if they're brave enough to go home and tell their spouse that they were fired for having an affair, they're probably going to go somewhere else anyway. So
that
ended the thing.
And the other side of the story is that you made this declaration, everybody needs to get sober and get right with their mates. And then you provided marriage and family counseling. You structured the company that made it family friendly. You awarded and rewarded people for in a family context, in a couple's context. And so it brought the families back together, oddly enough, and that caused the company to get back together and start turning a profit, right?
Employment stabilized, and the company made more than it had lost the year before the very next year. And God did it. I didn't. But right. It was it was just a matter of returning to biblical principles, and that's what we're about. We have to be about that in the workplace and in our home.
One of the things we've learned here in the series is was a quote from Martin Luther that when you work well, you are loving your neighbor. That loving your neighbor is one of the motives for good work. And what you've done, you were helping your neighbors, your coworkers in marriage and family by providing these opportunities to be rewarded, but also the counseling as well. I was reminded of a quote that came across in my studies. This is from Andy Crouch, and his wife is a professor of physics. And you would think, what can I do in that context to love my neighbor? And here's how she brings this value into her workplace. In her work as a professor of physics, Catherine can do much to shape the culture of her courses and her research lab. In a somewhat sterile and technological environment of the laboratory, she can play classical music to create an atmosphere of creativity and beauty. She can shape the way her students respond to excitement and disappointment in results. She can model both hard work and good rest versus frantic work and fitful procrastination. By bringing her children to work on rare occasions, she can show that the work is a culture for family, and it doesn't interrupt work, where research and teaching are a natural part of a mother's life. By inviting the students into their home, she can show the values that she values them as a person, not as units for research. And here's the summary statement. On a small scale, her laboratory in her classroom, she's been able to reshape her world. And I think as a boss, you can do some things. As a coworker, you can, again, structure relational strength and teach even relational skills, have them over for dinner or some sort of social event to suggest, hey, there's more to our lives than during the work week, and maybe we can learn from each other.
God provides us elements and purpose, just as Mike's song earlier talked about God never leaving you. I remember en route to Vietnam, Vicki and I went to my grandfather's house, and I always admired him, especially after my dad died. He was kind of the surrogate dad, and he asked me if I was afraid, and I said, I can't lie to you, I am. And he went in, got his Bible, came back out, and he had it open to Deuteronomy 31:6, and that verse says, be strong and courageous. It was Moses' directive. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid, for the Lord your God goes with you, even in the face of your enemy. And no matter what your enemy is, whether it be cancer or not having a job or a troubled time, God is with you. And that was one of the things that we learned, because we had settled on the fact that faith and family would get us through all of that. Mm-hmm. Actually, in about 3 years, because of my job and because of Vicki's job and God's grace, we were able to pay back all of those folks that had been affected, the banks, and we had sort of put it all in our past.
Right.
And in 1999, December 22nd of 1999, assembled all the vice presidents. I was president of the company by that time, and assembled all the vice presidents in my office in Dallas. And I was going to announce to them I was leaving the company that I was running to take over as president of a company called Fairchild Dornier that built airplanes. And that's kind of how we got back to San Antonio. But I was going to make this announcement, thank them, because really they were the structure that had bolstered me through these tough times, and give them their Christmas bonuses and tell them about my new job. Vicki and I had talked about it, prayed about it. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, all these folks are in from all over the country, sitting in the office, and a few minutes into the conversation, the telephone rang, and my assistant came running in and said, you need to call home right away, Dean. And Vicki knew what I was doing, so I was afraid that there was a family emergency, so I called her, and she said, Dean, you need to call this number right away. And it was a 202 area code. I don't remember all the rest of the number. But I called the number and the lady that answered, and I could hear in the background President Clinton talking on another line. And this lady said, Mr. Rush, I need to read this to you. This is what the president was going to read to you, but he's talking to someone else. And it said something like, because of your service in Vietnam and because of what you've done to declare family values in the workplace, the president has reinvestigated your crime, felt there really wasn't a crime, and you have a full pardon.
Great story. In all of that, you know, I mean, what, this is a little bit like a Disney story, though. I mean, that what you and your wife had come to was just only a couple things that you can only hold on to.
There are only two things that matter.
Right.
You may lose your house, you may lose a car, but the only two things that are always there are faith and family. So if you can concentrate on those things, they can get you through. Right. Because God will be right there with you through the whole time. I gave this speech in Dallas a few years ago, and there was a guy in the audience by the name of Chuck Swindoll, and he talked to me and said, I think I would like you to use this poem, and he put it in one of his books, David. And the poem was written by a lady by the name of Martha Snell Nickerson. And he said, I think this applies to you, so I'll give it to you now. And the poem goes something like this. It says, one by one he took them, all those things that I wanted and valued most, until at last I was empty-handed, and I walked earth's highways grieving in my rags and poverty, until I heard this voice from heaven say, hey, Dean, raise those empty hands to me. So I raised my hands to heaven. And into them he poured all of his transcendent riches until my hands could hold no more. And then I realized in my stupid mind and dull, God can't pour out riches into hands already full. My prayer is that your hands will always be full.
Dean, thank you for coming and joining us at Grace today, for living a wonderful life and sharing that with us, the many lessons. So thank you very much.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's, dear Lord, we are grateful for a life that's been lived so well, and Lord, we'd ask that you continue to bless the Rush family, and that you would bless them indeed, expand the boundaries of his ministries. Lord, I'd ask that as you refine his life in family and in parenting and in work, that we would see that you're refining our life in that context as well, that we would see things not as accidents or coincidences, but maybe as you're working in our lives so that we could be more like Christ, that you would be forging in us the character and attributes of Jesus Christ, about what we would be like if we weren't bent, us before the fall. So, Lord, I'd ask that you'd give us vision to see that, faith and family. I'd ask that you'd do that with clarity. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.